Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You know, I was watching or reading some folks chatting about the snow on Facebook the other day, and of course, this is Central Ohio, and they were complaining about the snow. The snows of winter, and no, the snow isn't here yet, although we have a little light dusting this morning. But they were complaining about it all the same, and I thought, there is one person out there who for sure will share my frustration with this sad denial of a season, and that would be Julie Zicafus. And perhaps you've heard her commentary on NPR or read her book, Letters from Eden. We're lucky to have her on the phone today from her 80-acre nature preserve near Whipple in southeast Ohio. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Ann.
Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
You know, you wrote in Letters from Eden that spring and summer slip by in a joyous, colorful blur, but enjoying winter takes a little more work, a little more adaptation from all of us. And those are, of course, Julie's beautiful words, not mine. Can you talk about that a little bit? What is it? Are we just now conditioned, so many of us, to just hate winter?
Well, you know, I have a friend in Connecticut named Hank who is an inveterate outdoorsman, and his favorite saying is bad weather looks worse from inside a window. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely true. I think it's just about putting on some layers and getting out. That's my if I could give people one bit of life wisdom that I've learned, if this were my last lecture, I'd say get outside, because it's just, you know, I don't know. When your life is so closely tied up with the turning of the seasons and you welcome each different thing that the seasons bring, it's just hard to imagine people saying, oh, yuck, I hate winter.
Yeah, some people think it's pretty to look at, but they don't like to walk in it. And I even like to do that because then when I take my dog out for a walk, she doesn't get all muddy.
See, there you go. There you go. The dog gets out the inner dog in all of us. And I think that's a huge function of dogs. I have one on my lap right now. So if you hear the occasional lip smack, that would be him, not me.
Okay, now I'm jealous. So winter, when you would take a walk every day?
I try to. You know, sometimes I just get out to slop the juncos, which is my term for filling the bird feeders. And I haven't done that yet this morning, and I'm getting some hard stares from a lot of birds. But, you know, like any person, sometimes my life gets bigger than me, and I don't get out for my hike. But I try to hike at least 3 times a week, you know, like a really good raise-the-sweat-on-your-body hike and, you know, get around and see some things and mostly just kind of clear my mind.
Because when you're walking, I mean, to notice things, sometimes you have to just stand still.
You do. Sometimes you have to just stand still or you know, you have to sort of clear your mind. You have to get that sort of zen-like state where you're not thinking about where the lost puzzle piece is or, you know, what I said to so-and-so and what I should have said, where you're actually just kind of a blank slate and open to whatever you're hearing and seeing. And that's a state of mind that's increasingly difficult to achieve when we're all, you know, clicking between Facebook and email and you know, we're just kind of staring into this little screen all day. And I'm, you know, guilty of that, too.
You moved to southeast Ohio, was it 1997?
1992.
Off by 5 years. Sorry about that.
That's okay. What
brought you to Ohio in the first place?
Well, I was kind of dragged out here by my husband, who is editor of Birdwatchers Digest, and he had to come out here to work for the family business on location as its editor. And I had been living on the East Coast for most of my life. I raised in Virginia and moved up and down the East Coast, and I wasn't at all ready for a move to the Midwest, and I wasn't sure I'd like it, but he brought me here in February, and it was all kind of gray, and it was the Mid-Ohio Valley, so of course, you know, there was no sun, and it was very wet, and I thought, oh boy, I'm not so sure I can do this. Then he brought me here in May, and he took me to a place called Newell's Run, which is just awash in every wildflower you can imagine, and I said, oh yeah, I can do this. So really, you know, I have to admit, there are some seasons that you kind of push through rather than just sail through.
Well, I don't know what they're called specifically, but I call them mud.
Yeah.
And that's my nemesis, is mud.
Mud is not
because
great.
I'm not exactly, you know, the neatest, you know, freak in town. You're writing a new book.
I am.
What's that about? What are you doing?
Well, the text is actually finished. It's a memoir about my life with birds and the many, many experiences, very personal experiences I've had with different species of birds. There are 25 chapters, and each chapter is devoted to a different species of bird.
Now, you have a few favorites, don't you?
I do.
Tell us who you favor.
Well, I'm kind of partial toward eastern bluebirds because I've been working with them since 1981, maintaining boxes for them and peeking into their nests and raising their babies when they're orphaned and cross-fostering them when I can find foster parents who will take orphan babies. So I've had a lot of experience with bluebirds, and they continue to teach me amazing things every year.
You do a whole lecture on bluebirds alone.
I do.
So there's some others, though, that you like.
Crazy
Phoebes.
About Carolina wrens.
Yeah.
Crazy about eastern phoebes. I'm crazy about all kinds of birds. I mean, you know, it's kind of like Thoreau said when he was sitting at a Thanksgiving table, they asked him which dish was his favorite, and he said whichever is closest, and he pulled over a dish of potatoes and filled his plate with them and ate nothing else. So it was kind of a little demonstration of just be happy with what you've got, you know?
You know, one thing from reading your book and your blog and going on your website, I don't get the feeling that you consider yourself an invasive species in nature. You have a real way of thinking. We all live here together, and,
yeah.
and that they know you as well as you know them.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I remember when I was a preteen and going through that sort of awkward stage, I remember thinking that all animals are beautiful except human beings. I thought my body was put together wrong. I thought I was gangly and homely. And I've really come to believe in the beauty of the human being as an animal and as a functioning unit in nature. And the exquisite adaptations we have, if we will only use them, for existing in nature. So I've really come 180 degrees on that, and I look at my kids and I think, my God, these beautiful little animals. So, yeah, I don't. I don't think that we have to feel like intruders in nature. I think that there are lots of ways to sort of slip into the glove of being outside and just become as one with the land as a deer.
Because they aren't particularly shocked by us necessarily. Once you're out there for a while, you can see things.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, all you have to do is be still and lower your voice or silence it altogether. I mean, I think a lot of what makes people say, oh, well, animals don't like me or I can't get close to things is that they never shut up, you know. and I'm that way. You know, I've had my husband shush me a lot when we're on field trips. You know, if I have somebody to gab to, I'll do it. But that's kind of why I like to go alone or just with a dog. And, you know, because you can approach animals and birds so closely if you just silence yourself.
Yeah, I know. I love my dog people down at the park. They're all wonderful. But when I first started walking my dog a couple years ago, I didn't know anybody, and there was a lot more solitude in it, and it was very nice.
Well, yeah. It's kind of like once you're well-known in a community and you go to the grocery store, gosh, you can't even get that darn can of beans, you know? You're just trying to make it down aisle three, and somebody comes up and tells you about a cardinal that's hitting their window or something.
Well, you know, that's kind of funny, some of the stuff you write about. You sort of take these little nuggets of things, and I was sort of fascinated by the idea that you sculpt meatloaf.
I do sculpt meatloaf, yes.
And I'm sort of jealous. I feel inadequate now.
Well, it's so easy, Anne. You too can sculpt your own meatloaf. No, the whole idea is, you know, you've got this blob of meat. Why not make it something? And I think it all started Chet Baker, my Boston Terrier, was sick a few years ago, like really sick in the hospital sick.
Ooh.
And some infectious thing that he caught, we never quite knew what it was, but he'd been in a place with a bunch of other dogs. And while he was in the hospital, I made a meatloaf in the shape of his head and with black olive eyes. And that seemed to make everybody feel better. And ever since then, I've sculpted meatloaf. I do skull meatloafs for Halloween. And my latest was a hamster-shaped meatloaf, which was actually kind of disgusting when it was raw, but it actually was delicious.
Yeah, that.
That
You're listening to Julie Zicafous. You may be here on National Public Radio. She writes commentary for NPR. She's also an author of Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. She lives in our very own Southeast Ohio since 1992. If you'd like to speak to Julie, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was interested. I was reading about moral mushrooms. I've noticed you wrote three essays on them, or I think on NPR about them, at least.
I did write a big one on morel mushrooms on NPR. I think I only had one commentary aired about morels.
Okay. Well, I saw three different commentaries, one in May of one year, one in June, and this year in April. So does the season actually span all that period of time?
In a good year, you can start picking morels in April and then kind of push it into late May. I've never found a morel in June, but they do come up. I mean, it's this past year was a wonderful one. We had them all through the orchard, and it was just absolute heaven.
One of the things I enjoyed very much was the conversation you had with your son when he asked you, what's the maddest you've ever been in your whole life? You know, it got me thinking. I was racking my brain trying to think of any kind of equivalent. Not that I haven't been mad before.
Right.
But tell our listeners about that.
Oh,
that was
my
very,
goodness.
I can't. It was very funny.
Oh,
I hope
goodness.
You don't mind I laughed.
Well, my son came up and said, Mommy, what's the maddest you've ever been? And I thought, well, that's such an interesting question. It didn't take me long, though, to figure out. I was standing in a parking lot of a Kmart in Marietta, and I had him in a car seat. He was just an infant. I mean, tiny baby. And I was preparing to load him into the car, and a beat-up pickup truck came whipping at about 40 miles of an hour through the parking lot and whipped in with a screech of brakes to the parking space where I was standing with my son in the cart. And it just terrified me, and I flung my body across my baby, as instinct will make you do. And when I recovered myself sufficiently, I kind of whirled around and I glared at the teenage drivers of the bus truck, and mm-hmm. I said, you know, something that wasn't very polite. And I asked them what the blank they thought they were doing, you know, driving that fast in a parking lot at dusk with people around. And that actually happens to be my king of pet peeves, is people who speed in parking lots when there are toddlers and mm-hmm. old people. So I go on this one-woman crusade to convince them all that it's a really bad idea, and whether by giving them the death glare or...
Or jumping
case,
on their...
Exactly. In this case, confronting them directly. So the driver just smirked at me, and he goes, chill, lady, chill. I responded unfavorably to that, and I wound up jumping on the hood of their truck and pounding on the roof with my fists and keeping time to my pounding by saying, you will never understand what you have done until you have kids, and that, I hope, is going to be a very, very long time. And so it was so interesting to read the comments that were emailed to the NPR website about this particular commentary. One guy in particular took it on himself to convince me that I was a psychopath and that these innocent children had been damaged by my tirade. And I disagreed.
What else did you hear? I mean, was that pretty typical of the response?
Well, it was so interesting. It seemed to me that it kind of split down parent, non-parent,
mm-hmm.
and the parents were completely got it, you know, just like, oh, my gosh, they are lucky that you didn't kill them, and, you know, this kind of comment. And the non-parents were very, very disapproving of my lesson. Now, mm-hmm. I have to point out in this instance that the truck was so beat up and had so many different colors of paint on it that my jumping on the hood did not, you know, significantly impact it.
I take it they did not press charges.
No. What happened? It was just kind of like, you know, when Gomer Pyle ran down the highway yelling, citizens arrest, citizens arrest. It was kind of one of those Gomer Pyle moments where you see something that is just so utterly wrong, and the lion in you rises
yes.
up, and you just set about to correct it, and no police involved, and no accident reports, nothing. You just say, no, this isn't going to happen here.
Oh, yeah. I've got a few of those. You just reminded me of something very similar when my son was very, 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 very young,
mm-hmm.
Newborn, and I was driving on the expressway, and here he is in the seat in the back of the, you know, in the back seat, in the baby seat, and someone, can't remember if they drove past me very quickly or they cut me off or something
that,
and it was a commercial truck, and it had the sign on the back, how do you like my driving? Call 1-800. So I called that poor 1-800 lady. She was, you know, probably pretty freaked out by the time I got done with her. But
probably.
We have to take a break right now.
Okay.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. You're listening to Julie Zickafoos. She's a writer and NPR commentator. We're lucky to have her for the whole rest of the hour, so stay tuned on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Next Monday, December 14th at 9 p.m., watch Anatomy of a Pandemic on WOSU-TV. In response to the 2009 H1N1 influenza virus pandemic, Ray Suarez from PBS NewsHour examines the human dimension of pandemic's impact on modern society and the science and history of these health crises. Catch this report from the front lines of the outbreak control effort next Monday night at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. 30 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few snow flurries this morning, and then cloudy skies for the afternoon and a high of 38 degrees. A few clouds this evening and a low of 25. And for tomorrow, clouds with a chance of rain, maybe mixing with a little sleet in the afternoon, and a high of 38 degrees for Tuesday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 and BR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today is Julie Zygafoos. She is a writer and NPR commentator. She lives down in Southeast Ohio. We're lucky to have her on the air today. Julie, you told us that you were going to be calling from your tower?
Yes, I'm in. We have built a 42-foot tall bird watching tower on our house, and it has a top that you can go out on with about a three and a half foot high retaining wall so you don't go tumbling off. And it's a 10 by 10 foot tower. And I happen to be in what we call the all-weather room, which is a glassed-in room below that top level. And I can sit here, and my favorite thing to do is come up here with the dog and a cup of tea on a snowy day and write. And that's where I wrote most of my newest book.
It sounds wonderful.
It is, and the snow is coming down, and it's so beautiful.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Here, let's talk to Marie. Marie, I could just tell funny stories and hoot it up with Julie all day, but you have some business to conduct. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Marie.
Okay. This is a question that just came up this morning, so I thought I'd call in and ask. A woodpecker was pecking on our house. It does happen to be a shingle house. And I wonder, is there a kind of paint that you could put on the house or something like that would keep that from happening?
No, there's no paint. But, Marie, is it pecking in one particular area?
Well, this morning it was, but on other days it's been in another place.
Interesting. Okay. So there's maybe one or two places where it comes repeatedly?
Yes, I would say so.
Okay. Has it done damage?
Well, there are holes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. This is the season when woodpeckers do this, and what they're trying to do, I understand, is not to find insects in your siding. They're not that dumb.
Well, that's what I wondered.
Right.
Go ahead.
To a woodpecker, your house looks like this big, wonderful tree. And so the best recommendation I can give you, and that I outlined in my book, Enjoying Woodpeckers More, is to take a bird box with a hole about 1.5 inches in diameter, and just a typical bird nesting box, and put it up over the place where the bird is pecking, and fill it with sawdust or wood chips. And the bird will then hopefully go about excavating, quote unquote, that box, tossing out the wood chips, and perhaps move into it as a winter roost.
So it's
looking for a home. It's trying to make a home for whatever dumb reason in your house.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I asked. My first question was, is it pecking on one particular area? And if the answer to that is yes, then it is. It may be trying to make a hole, which you don't want it to do.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Now there are many, many theories zinging around out there, one of them being that woodpeckers hear the hum of electrical appliances inside your house and think that they're insects moving around. I don't buy that.
Oh.
I don't think that's actually what's going on. I think that the winter roost theory, where they're trying to make a hole where they can sleep for the winter, is probably closer to what's happening.
Though this is high on the house, maybe we can hire somebody to put a box up there.
Oh, possibly so. And the other possibility would be scare deterrence. They can work, too. Get yourself some strips of shiny mylar or foil.
We've actually tried that one.
Okay.
A local company suggested it, and we went there and bought them, but it didn't seem to do the job.
You know, it's amazing how bomb-proof birds are when they have an idea.
and that
can be a real frustration, with birds who are hitting your window, fighting their reflections.
Uh-huh.
You can put a brass band out there, and the thing will still do it. So yeah, you've got a bird with a plan, and you've got to figure out what his plan is.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marie.
Thanks, Marie. We have a listener here who wrote to us, said it's not related to birds, but what would Julie recommend if my neighbors have raccoons living in their attic? They are noisy and fight on the roof every night and drive my dog and me crazy. Any recommendations besides moving? My neighbors won't really do anything about them. They pretend to care but don't. The raccoons are their pets. This is a true story.
Wow. You know, this is a people problem, not a yeah. coon problem. And, you know, obviously if these people accept having raccoons in their attic, there's nothing you can do. It's kind of like a neighbor with 17 cats, you know, that they let run into your yard. Obviously, the thing to do would be to wait until the raccoons are out foraging at night and then block up wherever they're getting in and out. That's what you do. But on someone else's house, you know, that's a human management problem. That's something where you know, they've got to accept that it's a problem before you can do anything about it. That's a toughie.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to talk to Julie Zicafus. She's on the air right now, and we're talking about just about anything, because that's the way Julie is.
You know what? I have another thought on that raccoon thing.
Okay.
This is a wild animal, and this is a wild animal that will smell sardines at a great distance. There's nothing to keep you from hiring someone to trap this animal, these animals, out and transport them to a safer place or dispose of them otherwise. So, you know, the raccoons don't know which is your yard and which is your neighbor's. So that would be what I do.
Okay. That's an interesting idea. You know, you have a, I think it was an essay or was it an NPR commentary about hummingbird summer?
Yes.
It was interesting. It said in a single July windstorm, two ruby-throated hummingbird nests blew down and were brought into the offices of Birdwatchers Digest. And you took over.
I did, and I'll start off by saying that I have the appropriate federal and state permits
okay.
to handle and raise wild birds.
Yeah, don't do. This is not something you should try at home.
Especially not
that.
With hummingbirds.
Right.
It ain't easy. Yeah, it was a pretty incredible experience, and it's actually the cornerstone of my new book, Hummingbird Summer, is the biggest chapter. And today I will do the final illustration for that chapter. I'm illustrating the whole book with paintings and sketches and drawings. And it was just a life-changing summer to be a mother to four baby hummingbirds, because they have to be fed every 20 minutes, and you have to have the right stuff to feed them. And in my case, I was lucky to have on hand a jar of powdered hummingbird maintenance diet, which is a high-protein brown powder that you mix into water and feed them. But it was so interesting, because I had this adult maintenance diet. I instinctively knew that it would not have the right kind of protein for babies, and so I hit on the idea of cutting the heads off of mealworms, squeezing out their insides like toothpaste, and feeding that to the babies on the end of a toothpick.
Obviously.
Obviously, yes.
Jeez.
I know. You've done it too. Admit it.
I can't even imagine. I mean, a hummingbird in and of itself is like the size of my pinky finger,
yeah,
or my thumb, let's be fair.
Right. When they came in the nest, they were so tiny that I gasped. I thought, oh, how can I do this?
Are they like the size of a thimble, or how do you?
Let me think here. At the age they were when I got them, mm-hmm. look at your thumb, and if you look at the last joint of your thumb, mm-hmm. they were about that long.
Jeez.
With a little beak sticking off that. Yeah. So, but you know, when they're hungry, they open up their beaks and peep, just like any other baby bird. So I could stick a dropper in the bill and pump them full of this nectar and then follow with a chaser of the mealworm goop. And that, I understand from subsequent conversations with wildlife rehabilitators who specialize in hummingbirds, is all that kept them alive, was this insect protein that I gave them.
Now, when did they start buzzing around?
Mine flew at about 29 to 30 days of age. So they're in that nest for a very long time, and that was what made it so challenging, was that you've got 3 weeks of every 20-minute feedings dawn to dusk. And the most frequently asked question that I get was, oh, my gosh, are you up all night? Everybody asks me that about mm-hmm. baby birds when I say that they have to be fed every 20 to 40 minutes. And I say, no, birds sleep all night. It's mammals that keep you up all night, which is why I don't do rabbits, coons, any of that. I like to sleep.
You took photographs of them. You do a lot of photography, a lot of beautiful stuff on your website. How does that translate, or how does that play a role with your art?
Well, it's such a luxury to have your own very, very close-up photos of these baby hummingbirds that you raised in order to work from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of why I started illustrating my book with that chapter, because I knew I had killer reference. I also work a great deal from life with life drawing and sketching. So most of the illustrations are done directly from the life sketches that I made of the living birds in front of me.
Okay.
So I use a combination of all those things and pull in reference from all directions. And I have to say, you know, when I'm doing, I have a chapter on ospreys as well, and I have sketchbooks from the mid-90s that I made of ospreys at their nest. And so I'll be using a lot of those sketches directly in the book. But then I'll also go to the Google image search if I need a particular pose or a wing position. And so an illustrator is able to just sort of amalgamate all these things mm-hmm. without copying any one of them. And the only thing that I feel free to copy is my own work, my own drawings.
One of the things that's so wonderful about Letters from Eden is it's not just your fabulous, beautiful watercolors, but also lots of sketches.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, are those just where you've just sat down with your sketchbook and you see a bird out there and it just inspires? How fast do you whip one of those babies out?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's you draw the moving parts first.
Okay.
and it's kind of it's a really specialized mental and physical endeavor to sketch animals and birds from life.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it is calming down enough to realize that, yes, you can do this. Because here's this thing hopping around and not keeping the same position for any nanosecond. So what you do is, the only way I can describe it is you try to burn the image that you want on your brain. And when I see the bird in just the pose I want it in, I will make a very, very rapid, maybe it just looks like a parallelogram, you know, with mm-hmm. some reference points on it. And then very, very rapidly fill in the leg position and the head position in that basic roughed out thing, and then I wait for the bird to assume that same position again, and then I work on it in bits and starts like that.
Isn't that a cool feeling to
yeah.
capture something like that?
Yeah, it really is, and it's something that is, you know, you can ease your way into it by, let's say you have a dog or a cat, and that animal is sleeping. Just do a sketch of it as it sleeps, and just get a feeling for its form. And then don't try to do it trotting or running until you've drawn it sleeping a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that would be my recommendation if people want to try this, is to just pick a pet and just get them when they're asleep or very peaceful. And then work up from there. And so, of course, songbirds are sort of the extreme slope of field sketching because they're never still. And so it's actually a bunch easier to draw something like a raptor or a water bird that will tend to sit and preen or stare off into space for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that songbirds sort of have going for them is that their shapes are a little less complex. You know, if you start with a basic egg shape, you've got the passerine or the songbird body shape, and then you kind of add appendages from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I guess my favorite birds to draw are birds with what I call real architecture, like turkeys and herons and things like
mm-hmm.
that, where you have this, like, really cool bunches of shapes sort of all slammed together into an animal.
The beaks play a big role as well, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. You've got to get that bill right and the proportion, the length to the rest of the head and the body and all that. And it's just a matter of honing your eye over time. And what's really interesting for me is, like, if I have a three-hour session with an animal, the sketches that I make at the beginning of the session, when I look at them at the end, don't look anything like that bird to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you refine your eye and you say, oh, yes, the eye is set lower than the corner of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
You do all this kind of stuff, and you ask millions of little questions about how this thing actually looks as you draw. And you answer those questions, and then you evolve.
You wanted to do this since you were 7 years old?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time.
It is. It's kind of a magic age to get hooked on something.
I'm really glad you're successful at it because of the psychological implications. So how did you, when you were 7 years old and you told people, is that what you would actually verbalize that to people?
I just knew I wanted to be an artist.
Okay.
And I knew that I wanted to study birds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just kind of a magic moment where I saw a special bird. It was a blue-winged warbler, and it was bathing in a little slough behind my parents' house. It was a migrant. I didn't know it at the time, but you know, the warblers kind of flooded through there in April and May, and this was in Virginia. And I happened upon this bird that was just the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, and it flipped a switch in me. And I think it's very important to watch for that switch being flipped in your own children and in children of passion, because then you offer the supportive materials that they may need to go on with that passion instead of just discarding it for the next thing.
You know, and you, did you go to art school and then go to the Nature Conservancy, or are you self-taught? How did that work? Because you didn't go on to be a quote-unquote artist per se. You went through the naturalist
route. Well, I always kind of thought
you're a beautiful artist, by the way. I don't want to imply.
Oh, thank God. Okay. No, my education, my formal art education, consisted of a summer program in watercolors when I was about 14, in the Virginia Governor School for the Gifted, and I got into that, and I was taught how to use the materials, and then I didn't have any more instruction until I got to college, and I studied under William Ryman at Harvard, as part of my coursework. I just took a drawing class from him for 2 years, and he taught me everything I needed to know to draw well, and I am still in almost daily touch with Will. It's a great joy to be in email contact with your college prof.
Yes.
So basically, the Nature Conservancy thing was I was consumed with the desire to work somehow helping save and conserve land, because that was just and still is to me the most important thing. I mean, you can talk all you want, but until you've actually bought the land that the thing lives on, you haven't done a lot. So I worked for the Nature Conservancy for 6 years in Connecticut, and I was a preserve design intern. And I just basically ran around the state using my own car, looking for the last best occurrences of all the rarest things in the state.
Wow.
And it was a tremendous education, because I had to do descriptions of the vegetation of each area that I visited. And then I had to go to town halls and look at plat maps and figure out who owned it and then contact those people. And so it was a very, very illuminating thing to do. It was unfortunately not lucrative, and so
that happens.
Yeah, and I was only employed for the summers, so I was left completely to my own devices in the winter. Having made, you know, maybe a couple of $1,000 that summer, I would be left all winter to my own devices. So I started illustrating newsletters and magazines and things like that, and just trying to get the word out that I was doing this for money. And you know, $25, $50 a drawing, and when I think how lean I lived then, it just amazes me.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah.
We got to take a quick break right now. You're listening to Julie Zicafus. She's a writer and NPR commentator. You've probably heard her many, many times before. You can hear her more. You can talk with her, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air, and I'm on a roll. It's been more than a year since a guest walked out on one of my interviews, but honestly, by the time you hear this, my luck may have run out. Tune in and see on the next Fresh Air.
And on Fresh Air in 20 minutes starting at noon, Jeff Moldauer, a singer-songwriter and frontman for the Texas Sheiks. For decades, he's been reinterpreting blues and jazz music from the 20s and 30s. He'll perform some songs, and we'll hear a few tracks from his new album. That's on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media for an exclusive family event to help your kids record a holiday greeting. Each family will receive a PBS Kids USB bracelet with their recording safely stored on it. Space is limited, with one USB bracelet per family. Call 614-292-9678 to register.
30 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds this afternoon, a high of 38. Evening clouds tonight and a low of 25. Looking ahead to Tuesday, clouds and a chance of rain, maybe a little sleet in the afternoon, a high of 38 degrees for Tuesday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Julie Zicafus. You might have heard her on National Public Radio. She's a frequent commentator. She's an author. She's an artist. Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods is in front of me now. And Julie, I was wondering if you also do a lecture on journal writing, which nature journal writing, which is sounds really interesting. And I was wondering if your journals are to your writing what those quick strokes of the pencil is to your painting.
Yes and no. It's funny. I'm kind of a first draft writer. So it's hard for me to write little sketches. I just kind of sit down and let it all come out. So,
even in your journal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the journal, what's kind of neat, and in the blog as well, what's kind of neat about that is that I can actually lift entire chunks from my journal or my blog and insert them into whatever article or column I happen to be writing, because that's the way I write. I mean, I may clean things up or, you know, a little bit or you know, remove little references that may not make sense, but that kind of thing.
I was wondering, too, in Letters from Eden, you talked about the multiflora rose.
Yes.
And that you don't particularly like it.
Right.
But you eventually came to see it through the eyes of a cardinal. But I was wondering about that and seeing nature in terms of other beings. How
yeah.
often that happens.
Well, it's very important to do that because, I mean, the reason multiflora rose is so common is because there are birds everywhere eating the hips and then scarifying the seed and then dropping that seed wherever they happen to be. And so obviously it's very popular with them because it's a vital winter food for them at this point. And I think what I'm moving toward is a sort of an idea that nature is always fluid, always changing. And that, yes, we do have to fight invasive exotics where we can and where it's possible. But there are some that are simply bigger than we are. And multiflora rose is one that will take over if we don't fight it constantly.
They brought it over here to, it had something to do with farming, right?
Well, you know, the living fence is something
the
Soil
fence,
Conservation
right.
Service has been looking for its entire existence and is still looking for. And anything that is thorny and impenetrable enough to make a living fence is probably a bad idea to plant on your property.
Well,
I mean, I'm just saying.
Well, you said that when they brought it over, they said, don't worry, it won't spread.
Exactly.
And I think, well, I'm not that bright, but I get the idea that the birds eat this, you know, anything from the plant and can spread it. It's not – and I just wonder, aren't those folks a little smarter than that?
Well, you'd hope. But the process we're talking about is called scarification.
Mm-hmm.
And the seeds, it's true. If you plant a multiflora rose hip right off the plant, it's probably not going to germinate because it needs to be tumbled around in the gizzard of a bird. Birds are more than happy to tumble the seeds around in their gizzards. So they didn't do those tests before they brought it in. They assumed it was sterile. They also didn't notice that it tipped roots. Multiflora rose will make a long arching branch. That branch contacts the ground, roots, goes on. That's called walking in botanical terms.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two mechanisms by which this stuff is just spreads like wildfire. And, you know, I'd love to think the Soil Conservation Service has learned its lesson, but when we had a representative out to our place to advise us on putting a pond in, we asked him what kind of things we might plant along its bank in order to hold the soil, and he said, oh, what you want is crown vetch, nothing but crown vetch. Well, that's an incredibly noxious, invasive exotic, and Bill and I looked at each other and rolled our eyes and thought, why did we ask? So they're still recommending, they're still planting, they're still putting things, a Russian olive, you know, plant that to hold a bank, and then what else does it do, you
right,
know?
Right. Well, now we're dealing with the Great Lakes and that invasive species of carp that everyone says it's going to be the end of Lake Erie if it gets in.
You know, I have to ask how a shipping channel can be so important as to wreck the ecology of the Great Lakes. Can we not close that channel? Can we not remove that conduit from the Mississippi to the Great Lakes?
I don't think I've ever heard anyone ask that question.
Well, you know, that's because we put commerce in front of ecology every time. And I look at this thing and I say, well, it's obvious. You know? But you know, I have to learn again and again that what's obvious to me as a person with a sort of an earth-first orientation is not in the least obvious to somebody who's more interested in shipping commerce. And so, of course, I wind up beating my head against the wall and pulling my hair out a lot when I read things like that. We made a communicating channel from the Mississippi River to Lake Erie, and it's up to us to close it.
That's Julie Zicafus, writer, NPR commentator. You probably recognize her voice. I think that Shetty does. Shetty, you're on the air, and you. All I saw was a story about a bird in the explanation line, and I kept thinking, a story about what bird? A story about what bird? But you must know what the story is, Shetty, so why don't you tell us?
This is a story about an eastern phoebe. I was hiking in the Glen in Yellow Springs about a year ago, and a bird came and flew. It was an eastern phoebe. It just flew in my face for a while. Then it landed in my hair and started picking pieces of hair, flying away with them, coming back. And this bird stayed with me for about a half hour. It eventually sat on my hand and posed for pictures.
Oh, my gosh.
Here we have another bird with a plan.
What was the bird's plan?
The bird's plan was, it was at the stage of lining its nest, which was probably, I'm guessing that there were some big sandstone ledges there.
Well, it was in October.
October?
It was October.
Planning ahead.
Oh, okay. This completely changes my thought here. October.
And I could send you these pictures. I sent them to the Smithsonian.
Uh-huh.
They have a bird website, and they took the pictures, and they said, this is totally unusual behavior for an eastern phoebe.
Well, it is. It absolutely is. But it's not unheard of in birds. The only thing that confounds me is that, you know, we got a wonderful submission to Birdwatchers Digest from a reader whose husband was sleeping in a hammock, and a tufted titmouse flew down and kept ripping out beakfuls of hair and flying off to line its nest. Now, if this had happened in April, I would have had no problem telling you what was going on. October, I have no idea what this bird wanted.
That hair was just too tempting.
What color is your hair?
Blonde.
Mm. Hmm.
Really thin, fine, blonde hair.
You didn't want to give any up.
Pardon me?
You didn't want to give any up.
No, the bird, I went back the next spring to see if it was building a nest and would want some more hair, but I didn't find it.
We do what we can.
I am completely confounded. I have no idea why the bird would do that. In animal behavioral terms, it was, this, your hair presented a supernormal stimulus to this bird. It could be that it was so attracted to the color of your hair that it just got a big picture in its head of nesting material and just did everything it could to get this nesting material, even though it wasn't the right season. The other thing that I would submit is that in the fall, a lot of birds undergo what's called gonadal recrudescence, which is where their gonads, their sex organs, their testes or their ovaries, briefly swell and begin emitting some very powerful hormones. And the function of this is thought to be to give the bird enough impetus to migrate. And so it could be that this phoebe was undergoing a period of gonadal recrudescence where it was getting a big hunk of estrogen or something. And it was looking at this hair and saying, oh, perfect for my nest. Little matter that it didn't have a nest at the time.
Kind of like one of those compulsive shoppers or something?
Something like that. The switch gets flipped and off they go.
Well, so. It took the hair somewhere, came back, got some more, and then it would fly off and catch flies and come back and eat them on my head.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Well, I have to tell you that the eastern phoebe is one of my favorite birds. My daughter is named for it.
So, I read that in your book.
Yes, I would. I'd give my eye teeth to have had that experience.
Well, I will try to send the pictures to Birders Digest.
Birdwatchers Digest.
Birdwatchers Digest.
Yes, that would be great.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thanks
for the call, Shetty.
Bye, Ann.
I read a very sweet essay that you wrote about grosbeaks.
Ah.
Is that how you pronounce that?
Grosbeaks.
Okay. Yeah, that was really sweet. Tell us about that.
Well, I had an amazing relationship with my dad, who was an Iowa farm boy transplanted to Virginia, who knew something about everything. He was an incredibly well-read and and educated man with a really big dose of just an earthy Iowa farm boy running through it all. So he was just a great guy. And when I was little, we had a flock of evening grosbeaks come in and invade our feeders. And this was in Virginia. This doesn't happen anymore. The evening grosbeak is a species that's on a steady, long-term decline really? In the East and is becoming quite rare. But back in the 60s, they did make these huge migrations when the seed crop would fail in the conifers that they used up north. They would come as far south as Virginia, North Carolina. And so we had a flock of 60 in our yard that stayed all winter. And my father made me a wonderful, wonderful windowsill feeder for Christmas. That was it was kind of a tray with a plexiglass top and bars for perching. And on Christmas morning, he had put a ladder up and he installed it. And I woke to the sound of the grosbeaks fighting over seed right beneath my bedroom window. And it was just a magical moment.
And so when you see them now, you try to make them stay.
I do. I haven't had grosbeaks at my feeder for probably, I'm thinking, about 1994 was the last time. That was the year my dad died. And we had them here in Ohio, a few at our feeder. And when I hear the call, it will bring me up out of a deep sleep. And I do everything I can to put out the right kind of seed. They love the gray-striped sunflower seed with the thick hull.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put out that seed, and I'll just pray that they stay because they mean so much to me.
How many bird feeders do you have?
Oh, let me count. I'm looking out the window here.
The way you talk, it sounds like you have one or two, but I just can't believe that.
Well, we have two feeding stations.
Okay.
One has three feeders hanging on it, and the other feeding station has, let me see, 6 feeders hanging on it. So I guess a total of 9 right now.
And you feel perfectly comfortable helping birds through a tough season?
Well, sort of.
Okay.
I mean, they're.
I like it, but
it's wonderful. I mean, with caveats. I mean, I've done a great deal of thinking lately about the kind of unplanned impacts that bird feeding can have, and I'm especially asking that question in terms of the birds that are supposed to be here versus the birds that we encourage to multiply in great numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm looking at a mourning dove flying through probably the first snowstorm of its life. It's circling around madly with its eyes closed. And we get a lot of mourning doves. We get a lot of cardinals here. On a good snowy day, we may have 70 cardinals under our feeders.
Wow.
Now, that is a sight that anybody would pay to see.
Yes.
But the question that I ask of myself is that really a good thing? When you have that many cardinals, and if they all or even some of them stay to breed, what does that do to the birds like the warblers, the thrushes, and the vireos that may be competing for the same insect food to feed their young?
Mm-hmm.
And so we are definitely artificially boosting some populations of birds preferentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to wonder if the decline of some non-feeder visiting songbirds may be linked to that kind of subsidy that we give the seed-eating ones.
Do you think you have 9 feeders? Do they all have different food in them?
Yeah.
Is that what you do? Why do you do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a finch mix with Niger and sunflower chips. We offer black oil sunflower. We offer roasted peanuts in cylindrical feeders, and we offer whole peanuts in the shell, and we offer mixed seed on the ground.
It's like your menu or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then I also add my special thick dough to that, which is a concoction made of cornmeal and rolled quick oats and flour and peanut butter and lard, which is a kind of a yellowish, crumbly substance that the birds are just mad for. And I know your listeners well enough now to tell them to go get their pencils and to copy this down if they wish. And that is the recipe for what's a peanut butter suet dough. It's very easy. 1 cup peanut butter, 1 cup lard. You can get that in tubs at some of the bigger discount stores, or you can get it in the dairy case. So 1 cup peanut butter, 1 cup lard. Melt those together in the microwave until liquid. Add to that 2 cups yellow cornmeal, 2 cups rolled quick oats, and 1 cup flour. It's best to combine the dry ingredients first and then add them to the liquid ingredients.
Now, why quick oats?
It absorbs the oils from the lard and the peanut butter better and disappears into the mix. The old-fashioned oats will sort of separate out of the mix.
Okay. In the book you mentioned, it may be because your website, I might be confusing them, but you said sometimes you want to dip your finger in there.
Oh,
I do. It looks so good.
Oh, my son and I eat it. It's terrible. I mean, you don't want to go around eating lard. You really don't. But it does smell fabulous. The only caveat that I have about feeding it is that it is a very rich stuff. And mm-hmm. so I actually am only going to make my first batch for the season today as the snow comes down.
So you make this, you turn it into a brick or something? What do you do?
It's a friable, crumbly dough.
Okay.
And I serve it in very small amounts, just on the deck railing or in a dish. And I serve it right by the kitchen window. And that keeps the starlings from coming in because starlings just adore it. So I serve it right where I can be standing there, right on the other side of a pane of glass when I feed it. And I get things like bluebirds and Carolina wrens and field sparrows and towhees coming right up to the kitchen window to get it.
See, you know, I've been noticing lately, and unfortunately it's always when I'm driving and I'm afraid I'm going to get into an accident. I don't know I'm not sure what kind of birds they are. I want to say swallows, but I may be way off. They fly together in these gigantic groups, and they sort of create these amazing patterns.
Yes.
Is that a seasonal thing?
Yeah, you're seeing that right now, right?
Yeah, right now.
Yeah. The blackbirds do this. Starlings
okay.
do this. It's probably
starlings.
Most likely to be starlings right
okay.
now. But red-winged blackbirds and grackles will do this. And this is one of my favorite bird phenomena to watch.
I love
this swirl. It's just absolutely incredible. And what they're doing is they're kind of massing, and they're coalescing and massing together, and then the flocks kind of break apart and then coalesce again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's usually in response. If you're sharp enough, you can usually scan the sky and find Coopers or a sharp-shinned or a red-tailed hawk flying that they are reacting to.
Oh.
And so what they're trying to do is lessen the chance that any one of them will be nabbed by making a tight flock like that.
And they ripple through the air like a ribbon or something.
It's unbelievable.
And
yes.
I've seen them a couple times in the same place over Route 270,
uh-huh.
just right by 71.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why. I mean, maybe I just keep looking up and they're there.
Well,
if you look up often enough.
There may be a grain field there that they're feeding in.
Okay.
And that's generally where I see it is in the more heavily agricultural areas of Ohio, and I really look forward to that. I actually will pull over just to watch a flock do that. And you know, what you're seeing is something that mammalian muscle can't react fast enough to do the kind of maneuvers in concert
right.
that avian muscle can, because avian muscle actually has a different neurotransmitter, a different kind of ATP running through it that can take nerve messages across the synapses faster than mammalian muscle.
But how do they know what each other's doing?
Well, they see the movement start and they react to it before we have even perceived that it is happening. And so they're actually closely watching and sensing what the bird right next to them is doing, and they're all acting almost in unison.
Well, it's fabulous. Thanks for explaining that to me.
Mm-hmm.
We're run out of time.
Oh, rats.
Yeah, I know, rats. I hope you'll be on again.
I'd love to.
Great. My guest today is Julie Zicafus, writer, NPR commentator. You have a new book coming out. What's the name of the new book? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. But it's going to have a really fabulous chapter about hummingbirds. We do know that. So,
you know, I could call it Hummingbirds and Other Birds I've Known, but there are 25 chapters. So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Life Birds is the working title, but I'm not sure that'll be the final title.
We'll find out later.
Okay.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.